Rita Dragonette is a writer who, after spending nearly 30 years telling the stories of others as an award-winning public relations executive, has returned to her original creative path. The 14th of September, her debut novel is based upon personal experiences on campus during the Vietnam War. She is currently at work on three other books. She lives and writes in Chicago, where she also hosts literary salons to showcase authors and their new books for avid readers. We're going to talk about that and more. Rita, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Maria. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on. So I may have mentioned this to listeners on the show before, but I was so particularly intrigued by this. My dad was a Vietnam vet, and I was born after the war, but I kind of came to feel like the Vietnam War was almost another family member in our house growing up. And so whenever I see books written about the war, people in, you know, kind of captivated by that time of our history, it my ears always perk up. So so this was wonderful, and I've never read a take on the war anything like this, so this was a treat. I guess before I get too far into that, I should allow you to introduce the book and kind of take us into the 14th of December and clue our listeners in on what I'm talking about here.
Oh, sure, I'd love to. The 14th of September is a woman's story of Vietnam, which does make it distinctive. And it follows Private First Class Judy Talton, who is in college on a military scholarship, which is the only way that she can afford to go to school and have the kind of independent life she wants. But the time frame of the novel is late 1969, early 70, and Judy has been having doubts because the war has been escalating. And because in her program she's actually enlisted in the Army, she's wondering if she's complicit and how she should be feeling about it. So what she does is, as the book opens, she decides to celebrate her 19th birthday, which is the 14th of September, by secretly going underground into the campus counterculture just to see what the other side thinks. And by doing this seemingly small exploratory step, she actually puts her entire life into jeopardy. If the Army finds out, she will lose her hard-won scholarship and her relationship with her military family, her future. She could even face legal action. If the counterculture finds out she's in the Army, they'll think she's a spy. And all of this takes place on a backdrop of these huge things happening historically, the March on Washington, the draft lottery, Kent State, and Judy is plunged into a journey of self-discovery that I call a coming of conscience, to the point where she feels that she needs to make a decision that is every bit as emotionally fraught and difficult as any that is by any male draftee of the time.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about your point of entry into the novel and kind of how it came to you, if you feel like you found this book or if you feel like it found you, and if it began with character, if it began with circumstance, sort of the origin story for you.
Well, it was actually a very personal story. The foundation of the things that, of Judy's dilemma in the story, being on a military scholarship and being conflicted, is something that I actually encountered at that time. And there was something that did happen to me, and it is it's reflected in a scene in a book, which really was the first time that I ever felt like I was a coward. And it was during this time on campus, and there were people for inappropriate reasons, of course, dissing a vet. And I felt, I was furious, and I thought, oh my God, I've got to get up and say something and stop this. No one else is doing this. And I did not do it because I was a girl, and I didn't think anyone would listen to me. Mm-hmm. And I sort of vowed that I was never going to feel like a coward like that again. And I was certainly never going to let, this was early, the early years of feminism, I was never going to let my female status get in the way of that. And then when I left school about a year later, somebody who was at school with me and in this sort of group of characters sent me a letter and said, there is a story in those years and you're the one to tell it. And those who know me would know, if you give me a quest, I'm like a dog with a bone. So I always knew that I needed to write this story, And I always knew that it had to be a woman's point of view. I'm very interested in women in war. My mother was in World War II. But just the fact that women go through, like you said, your whole family felt like it was in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's in your family, if it's in your whatever, you know, the women go through the same thing the men do. Men do in terms of intensity and horror. Death means different things in different ways. Grief means different things in different ways. And I always felt that men and women had equal status, but that it wasn't always recognized. And Vietnam was a very good example of that.
For sure.
And it hadn't, and no one was telling the story. Right. I kept waiting for it to be told, and here it was.
Right, right. Well, I'm glad you did it, because we could have a whole separate hour-long discussion on all the things that I could unpack in my own life, but if we had time for that, but it really resonated on a lot of levels. And, you know, it's hard to read this book when knowing that you started it, I guess you started, so it took you 12 years to write. And so you must have started it kind of during the Bush administration. You were writing it during throughout the Obama administration. And I just always think it's interesting. You know, I always talk on the show about the world the book is born into. And this is yet another one that it's coming out in a world, in a context that looks so hauntingly familiar in certain ways to the world that you were writing about. And I guess the first question for that is, through the dozen of years that you were writing the book, the story is the story and Vietnam is fixed in time and the characters are who they are. But I wonder if the outside world, if you could feel the world changing around you, if you felt like that had any impact at all on your writing of the book. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I call it the hamster wheel of history. And there were, as I went through a great deal of these moments of time, I kept thinking, oh my goodness, I should have written it years before, and maybe then some of these things wouldn't have happened. You know how you get very, as if I could control that. But, you know, you watched the generation that was involved in the 14th of September, which is set 69-70, is the one that was going to change the world. And, you know, we failed at that. We tried really hard. We were definitely instrumental in ending the war, but it didn't really feel that way because it went on for another 5 years. And, you know, a lot of us got kind of gutted and we went into the me generation. You know, I don't know that I can have faith in government after this. I'm going to take care of myself and my family and all of this. But you always wanted to come back to it. So here I am going through three careers. I was in PR and then I was a consultant. Trying to work on the book part-time while you're doing that. And trust me, don't start a business and a book at the same time. It always wins. But yes, we went through all of those different eras, and it actually felt like it was going to get a little more hopeful, you know, right, with Obama. But then the Never Again movement comes in, and that's got four factors that are the most similar to what we went through in Vietnam, and which is staggering. You know, it's young people who don't have a political voice and no vote, and their government's not taking care of them with legislation, and their institutions aren't taking care of them, and their parents aren't by voting for the right people. And that's exactly the kind of thing we were going through in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people that were going were 18, 19, and 20-year-old teenagers, children.
Right.
Who, and the line was, if you remember from those days, was that you were too young to vote, but not too young to die.
Right.
And, you know, so we know that political power was really, really important, and we didn't go after it that much. And so you watched Bush, and you watched all these different things come through, and I just felt like, oh, my God, this is uncanny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just uncanny. I was actually having one of my literary salons, and we were talking about my book at the end of the introduction of someone else's, the night that Trump sent, you remember he called it the mother of all bombs?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. That just sort of went in, and it was uncanny. And I got a text from someone during the salon, and he said, okay, here we go again.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So it's here. You know, it's definitely here.
I always converse with writers about whether or not the universe is showing them signs that they're, because writing a novel is so long and it's so hard and it's so tedious. And so I often ask, you know, kind of what sustains you during those long years, and does the universe ever give you any signs that you're on the right track, or that what you're doing is really important, or that, you know, the world is listening? And it sounds like you got more than your fair share there.
Well, I have to tell you that for most of the years I was writing the book, lots of people were saying things like, why are you writing about Vietnam? It's bad. We lost. We did terrible things to Vet. We did atrocities. Who cares? You know, Obama. But I knew that it was more important than ever than to go ahead and do that. And somebody actually in one of my salons called Vietnam the Voldemort of wars, you know, that which will not be named. And that doesn't make history go away. I mean, it's in the DNA of all of us and our country and how we have done these different things. So I was, like, compelled. And then Ken Burns comes out.
Right.
And talk about a sign from the universe.
Right.
So I spend 10 years or so writing this with people saying, why bother? No one's going to, you know, care about this. And then Ken Burns comes out with his remarkable PBS series that I feel that every American should see.
Yes.
And then Spielberg comes out with The Post. And then 3 weeks ago, do you watch This Is Us?
I have watched the first season, and then I kind of dropped off halfway through the second season, so I'm not caught up, I'll admit.
Well, about 2 weeks ago, something like that, they had an episode, and it was about the draft lottery.
Oh, my God. That's funny.
And it was right out of my book, as I depicted, and it was also a perfect analysis of why we can't forget any war, let alone Vietnam, because in that television show, which is incredibly popular, yeah, a son is trying to understand his father's experience in Vietnam so he can understand himself and his dynamics and his family.
Yeah.
And isn't that why we write historical fiction, and isn't that why we study history? To learn the lessons so we don't get into the hamster wheel of history.
And look where we are. Right.
Yeah,
right.
I know.
So good. So I had read that a writing professor sort of gave you permission to use just the foundation of yourself to get into this novel, because I think that's one of the very difficult things for a writer to sit down, even if you know what you want to write about, just trying to find the door in on that blank screen is really difficult. And so I was wondering if it felt just like wonderful permission for this mentor to say to you, look, you can take your own life as much as you need to just shove off from the side of the pool. And then, you know, once you're out there swimming, your characters will become who they are and the story will be what it will be. But that initial push off to use you know, what you need to use of your own life to get you started. I don't know. Did that feel like a gift or,
well, it opened up a door. And it also opened up a lot of difficulties to the process. What I ended up doing is I went to this instructor that I had, because I was just writing scenes, and he said, you know, you don't have a narrative arc here.
Hmm.
And I said, I really need a dilemma for Judy, my main character, that's got the same kind of gravitas that I went through, and I can't think of what it was. And I was telling him all these specific things that I'd gone through, and he looked at me like I had two heads, and he goes, Rita, you're a writer. This is what writers do. So that allowed me not to be self-indulgent. That's what I had felt. For example, I could very easily have called my main character, who they all have musical names, and I call her Judy Blue Eyes, and I could easily have called her Lovely Rita,
mm-hmm,
but I did not do that. I thought that was a little much. But then that also took me into, so that allowed me a way in, but I have to say that the most difficult process of writing the story was to let go of things that really happened and have it create its own fictional life.
Right.
There were many times where I just resisted going places and resisted workshop comments because in my head I was going, but that's not exactly what happened. And I had to just let that go, and I did it 2 weeks into a very intense residency at the Ragdale Foundation in Chicago. Cool. And that's when I just let go, and suddenly the characters were going the way they wanted to go, and it became a fictional novel at that point.
Interesting.
It was very hard.
That's interesting. One thing you said that I'm so happy you said is that you initially were writing this as fragments or as, you know, different scenes. And
yes.
I know so many writers in writing groups I've been in that have worked that way. And it inevitably seems to be so hard for them then to piece it together, you know, because then they'll have 400 pages of fragments and scenes, which does not a novel make. And, but it is a very hard inclination to get away from doing it that way. So if you could talk just for a second, I think this would be so helpful for people to hear, how you made that transition from having a pile of fragments to having a novel.
Well, it was extremely painful. So, the first fragment I wrote was this story I referenced a few minutes ago about the vet.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to do it as a series of link stories, and I think I was just being lazy because I thought that would be easier.
Mm-hmm.
So all the linked stories were really fragments that took place at the end of the book. And then I realized that this was a novel. So I had these fragments. And I had one, you know, on lottery night. I had, like, the big fragment scenes. But I had to go all the way back and create a beginning.
Mm-hmm.
How would this story start? It wasn't just my way into it. It was like, what is the scene on page one? And for years I kept thinking, boy, if I could just put these all on an arc, you know, like a clothesline, in the order that they need to be,
mm-hmm.
and then I could sit back and edit, that would be wonderful. But it took such a long time to do it because I wrote it over a long period of time. There was legacy writing in it. I had, you know, you had to give up on things that you really loved, that people had loved in workshop, and it was really, really hard to do that. And it was like doing a synopsis backwards, which is what I did. And I won't ever do that again.
Yeah.
Is
that what you did, was sort of, because I know somebody who literally did put a clothesline in her office and hung scenes off of it. Did you do that? What does your office look like?
No, I think that's but I had, one of my editors had a, you know, a process where you'd use note cards for something like that.
Oh, yeah.
I wished that I had been that analytical. I just did this the hardest way you could possibly do it. Now, the way that I'm going to do the future ones are, I ended up having the good fortune of dealing with two remarkable editors while I did this. Because, you know, I came out of another career and I thought, I'm not going to live long enough to master how to do this without some expert help. So my last editor was Jacqueline Mitchard, who wrote The Deep End of the Ocean. And I used her as a developmental editor. And she actually taught me that, you know, I'm going to try this on the next book, is to just really make such a detailed synopsis that you can call it a clothesline, you can call it a graph, you can call it an Excel sheet, whatever it is, but so that you know exactly what is going to happen, and don't start writing until you've done that. And I know that some writers are intuitive and they just write and find their stories, and others are overly plot-oriented. I started out being overly, and I backed into the rest of it. This time I just want to have some structure to it so that I get a better sense of where I'm going, knowing full well that it will change.
Right.
But I won't be, like, writing into the deep beyond.
Right.
Yeah.
Good advice, yeah. My guest this morning is Rita Dragonette. The book, The 14th of September, is out and available now. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You also mentioned legacy writing. I haven't heard that term, but I really like that term. I'm going to steal that now. But when you write over the course of 12 years, obviously you change as person, as writer. Hopefully you get better as writer. And so you do have all of these pages, I guess, that don't match the current pages. And I was just wondering about that process of, you know, kind of what you do with 12 years of writing to keep everything kind of currently in the voice you have today.
That, again, was another thing that was so incredibly hard, because I would, over that period of time, sometimes I took a year off. You know, and then I would come back, and I would go back and forth and do these things. And I learned to write tighter. I'm a very good dialogue writer.
Yes, you are.
But what I, thank you.
Yes.
But what I end up doing is, because I am, often my dialogue scenes are too long.
Hmm.
And I can, you know, and people will tell me that, but they can't exactly tell you which ones are too long or where they're too long. And then you'd get all this feedback, but it's really, really good. And you were in the middle of this going, well, what's the part that goes, you know?
Right.
So then you had to go back, and I know that some of those were, almost all of those were legacy writing things because they were so much fun to write, and they just, like, pour out of me, and then I didn't want to give them up.
Yeah.
And as the story went on, particularly as you can tell in the novel, it gets faster and faster as it goes.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, there's the big scenes at the end. Those don't have as much dialogue.
Uh-huh. Right.
They have hopefully the critical amount of dialogue, but they don't have long dialogue scenes, and they don't have, it just moves much faster.
Right.
And then it did in the beginning, and it was really hard to get the pace to match. And I don't think it, you know, I'm sure I'm going to read this in a, you know, 2 years and go, oh my God, I left that in there. Why didn't I take that out? But it's very hard to have perspective on your own writing, even if it's legacy writing.
Yes, right. And every writer does that. I haven't talked to a single writer who says I wouldn't go back and fiddle with it. So I think that's just built into the stock price of being a writer.
Well, and every time you read a scene, I'm going to a salon in an hour, and I'm going to read a scene, and every time I read it, I go, oh, I should have changed that, right?
Yeah,
I could do that tighter. I could be tighter with that.
You can do that during the reading, you know, they'll never know. Well, maybe they would know.
Well, I do have reading scripts, you know, where you take out references to other scenes in the book that are irrelevant, and it makes all the difference in the world when you're reading.
Yes, right. And another point you brought up about writing groups, I wanted to touch on, because I've been in a writing group for a really long time, and the group has been together for a long time, and we always have this debate about when to show each other work, what critiques to listen to, and sometimes I'm critiquing people's work, and I'm like, maybe I'm just saying this to say something, and I'm actually really hurting this person, or not hurting the person, but just, you know, I'm not being helpful to the work, because, you know, we're all kind of there to say something. And so I was wondering if you could just talk about your critique group, how it works, and kind of training your ear to listen to the right critiques and to deliver the right critiques.
Yeah, well, I have a lot of experience dealing with groups and workshops going way back. And actually, this very same instructor that told me to listen to myself is the one who said at some point you're going to have to go beyond workshops.
Mm-hmm.
And I did in my PR career, of course, I was an editor a lot. And when somebody gives me a piece of writing, I take it extremely seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll go anywhere from line editing all the way to, hey, it's too slow here, it's this and this and this. And I want them to do that to me as well. But I you don't always get everything that you want, you know, back from somebody. Actually, it's somebody, and all they did was circle adverbs, and it's like, well, okay. but I need something a little more meaty. And, you know, and the watchwords are what I have learned, because then I went into another writer's group, and I'm actually desperate to find a new one right now as I go into this new book,
mm-hmm.
because the people that I worked with before have dispersed.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to get back into it where I really trust it. But I wrote an article about this once, and they said, when do you show work? And my personal opinion is that you show it in two times. One is when you're running into a problem. Take it as far as you can, and you just have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I can't make this work, and I don't know what's wrong, and I don't know what to do with it, and I need other perspective. But don't make it raw copy. Take it as far as you can to that problem so that they can look at the problem and see it very clearly as this is what needs to be fixed. They may have other ideas too,
mm-hmm.
but you won't be wasting their critical time on things you already know are wrong. And then the other thing is when you really do think you've got something that's finished, you know, whether it's a chapter or a scene or a substantial part of it, if you're feeling that this is good, it's like then it's ready for other eyes too.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I think that a lot of people get very demoralized in groups and workshops when they take in like really rough work, because then you get, you just having people tell you what you know yourself.
Right.
You know.
Right.
That this is too long, that this is too this, that this is too this. And that's when it's like having respect for the other people that are in the group.
Right.
You want them to bring their best work or their most critical evaluation, coming in and saying, for the life of me, I cannot come up with a beginning here that's got enough zip.
Yep.
You know, right. And I need something like that, or I think this ending works, but I am not quite sure. Or is this dialogue scene too long? Or does this really, is it as magnificent as I really think it is, and it's like a ballet and I can't take one word out?
Right, exactly.
You know, it's those kinds of things. And my quest right now is to find a group of writers that where we're all at a similar level.
Yes.
That we're not, you're not, because very often when you have a group, you know, if there are, our writers are at different levels, you spend more time with the writers that need more help.
Right.
And you don't get what you need.
Right. Right.
So I'm actually in the process of looking for that right now, but it's incredibly important because you never really know. You know, you're at the computer and you're just going, am I a genius today or am I just bleh?
Yeah.
No.
Right. Right.
And what will I be tomorrow?
What will I be tomorrow?
Yeah. Or in 10 minutes. Yeah.
Right. Oh, we're drawing down on our time. We've already... I would love for you to say something about these literary salons that you have, though, because those sound so wonderful.
They are. I have to say they're wonderful fun. I'll talk fast so we can get it in. But they started when it was about 10 or 12 years ago. I had a friend who was a screenwriter, and she wrote a book to sort of give herself cred in that area. But she and I said, well, you're going to do readings. And she had never been to a reading. And she was terrified at the prospect. And I said, well, you know, here's what I'll do. And I invited about 20 people I know who are just very avid readers into my living room. So it was a very safe environment. And I introduced her and all of this. And she was able to introduce her book and read a segment. And we had the most amazing discussion. It's not a book club, so people haven't read the book.
Right.
But they're introduced to a new author and their intention for the book and, you know, about 10 minutes worth of reading. And people come, I do it about twice a year. I haven't done it this year because it's all me with the book launch. But I do it about twice a year, and there are, you know, there are lists of people who are like, could I possibly have my book be selected? And could I, you know, come to your salons? I'd really like to be able to do that. So now I get about 25 people. Every once in a while, they're a little larger, and I take them outside. But the magic, I think, is being in my living room. You know, it's just very, it's
intimate,
it's personal, and I can talk about what I'm doing, and then my readers trust me that these are writers that I think they would like.
Right.
And I've learned a lot over the years. You know, I've learned about, you know, just doing a favor for somebody and then it's a book that doesn't really match with this. But I think that is how, that's how we experience books. That's why book clubs are wonderful. That's why readings are wonderful. It's just the one-on-one. And I remember that from business even when we were doing that with clients. It's like, you know, to be able to have this intimate one-on-one, very personal exchange is the very best experience with a book. And I'm sure you've run into that where you've read something and you think, oh, it's okay, and then you hear the reader read it.
Yes.
Or the writer read it.
Right.
And you go, oh, my God.
Totally different experience. Yeah.
It really, and you realize, oh, I read that. You know, I totally missed the level that I'm supposed to be looking at. And then you hear the words come out, too. And that, to me, is magical.
Yeah.
That's why we need, you know, we still need our libraries and our bookstores. You know, in Chicago we have a very thriving independent bookstore community, mm-hmm. and you can interact. And I've never been in a circumstance where I've read this without people wanting to buy it,
right.
You know, or hear more about it or talk about it. Even if they come up and say, the subject of Vietnam still makes me very upset, but I'm going to buy this from my mother. Mm. I'm going to buy it for someone else because I know it's important, and then when I'm ready, I'll read it.
Right. Such a great book. So fun to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
We could talk like another hours, but
I'll come back anytime you want.
I would love that. I would love that. This was a real treat. Is there a last minute word of wisdom or advice, having come through this 12-year process and now it's out in the world, that you, I know you're going to approach the whole second book differently, but other advice that you can share that you learned along the way?
Well, probably, I think one of the unique things that I have is that I am a marketer. So I came out of PR and a writer, and most writers are not, and they hate the marketing process. And I would just say, learn to love it, because that's when you have these interactions with your readers. You know, to put all of the story in and then not be really excited about all exploring all the venues like this show to be able to talk about it is not only cutting the pleasure of your readers, but it's cutting your pleasure. Talking about it is every bit as exciting as reading it. It's all senses get involved in a story.
I love that. Right. Rita Dragonette, you have a great website up there, too, and there's a ton of interviews. I mean, we didn't get so much into the book as much as I would have liked to, but there are really wonderful interviews up on the web that folks can, a great trailer for the book and different interviews that you've done more that delve into the content of the book. So people, you're all over the place online, so people can check you out.
It's the marketer in me.
I love it. I love it. This was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.